Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Governor John Carney went before a joint session of the General Assembly this week, offering his plans for where to take the first state despite its fiscal woes.
Our dreams for our children's future don't disappear because of a budget crisis. The needs of our state's most vulnerable become no less acute. We cannot and we will not let our budget challenges halt the wheels of progress.
We'll bring you key pieces of Carney's speech, lawmakers' reaction, and analysis with political reporter James Dawson. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine the struggles shopping malls face and what ones here in the first state, like Concord Mall and Dover Mall, can do to survive. And we have this month's edition of History Matters. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Governor John Carney went before a joint session of the General Assembly this week and in a nearly 30-minute speech outlined his vision for the first state going forward in light of the budget pressure Delaware faces with a projected $386 million revenue shortfall to overcome in 2018. Carney said in his speech the state can't stand still just because of its budget problems, adding it needs to become more competitive to climb out of its deficit and move forward. And his efforts to make the first state more competitive will start with following through on his promise to change the Delaware Economic Development Office.
We need a new, more dynamic economic development strategy, one that can leverage the resources of our business sector, as well as higher education and the not-for-profits. The Delaware Economic and Development Office needs to be at the forefront of moving Delaware into the 21st century economy. So my first act as governor was to find a way to energize our economic development efforts. We're going to do that by bringing private sector involvement into DEDO. A new and improved DEDO, a public-private partnership, will be put to work right away, creating job growth projects like Insight's expansion on Augustine Cutoff. It will look for ways to strengthen our pipeline of skilled workers by supporting efforts like Zip Code Wilmington and the HORN program at the University of Delaware. It will foster a culture of innovation through partnerships with the Star Campus and the Delaware Technology Park. And it will help bring a new group of job creators with innovative ideas to our state. The DEDO Working Group will issue its report next week. Then we will get to work with the General Assembly to make DEDO more effective at attracting and retaining good-paying, middle-class jobs of the future.
Carney also wants to redevelop brownfields around the state, believing they can attract investment that turns into jobs. But he says, to make the most of them, you need to allow ones along the Delaware River and Bay to be part of the plan.
Other brownfields will require a fresh look at our venerable Coastal Zone Act. I don't underestimate how difficult this will be, or how important it is to protect the beautiful natural areas along our coastline. But I'm committed to working with all the relevant stakeholders to modernize the Coastal Zone Act. Our goal is to allow redevelopment in parts of our state that were once home to good-paying manufacturing jobs. I believe we can make reasonable changes to this law that will protect our environment while allowing our economy to grow. I want us to work together over the next few months so that we leave here in June with reasonable reforms that will leave our state better off.
Education was on Carney's mind as well. He spent a fair amount of time talking about education, reiterating his plan to reshape the Department of Education and its mission.
Perhaps more important than anything we do to strengthen our economy is getting our schools on track and making sure that every child in our state is college or career ready. With fewer resources, we need to make better use of what we have, beginning with the Department of Education. I've asked Secretary Bunting to lead my effort to reorganize the department so that it's more responsive to the needs of teachers and administrators. Educators should see the Department of Education as another player on their team, not an obstacle to progress or a drain on their resources. Starting in her first week in office, Secretary Bunting has been spending time in the classrooms with teachers in our most vulnerable schools. She's asking them what they need to be successful and designing a plan to get them what they need. For each school and each district, the needs will be different. One school may need a stronger preschool program, so students arrive at kindergarten ready to learn. Another may need a good after-school program. Our solution will not be one size fits all. And we will be coming back to the legislature and school communities with our plan to reform the Department of Education. We will make the department responsive to the needs of the teachers and students in the classroom. The budget I proposed last week had almost no new spending. One exception was in educating our most vulnerable students. My budget includes a down payment on education opportunity grants, a program that will direct more resources to our schools with the neediest students. The debate over district boundaries in Newcastle County has been raging for years, and we will continue to engage on those issues. But we should not allow the politics of redistricting to distract us. This is about the kids, after all.
Carney also outlined his plans to respond to Delaware's ongoing opioid crisis and the impact it's having on families up and down the state.
A major impediment to families being stable and successful is the opioid crisis plaguing our state and our country. When last measured, Delaware had the nation's fifth highest overall rate of opioid sales. And in too many cases, opioid abuse contributes to our state's tragic heroin problem. Effective April 1st, we will impose new protections for the safe prescribing of opioids. These regulations will be some of the most far-reaching in the nation. And working with Attorney General Dent, we have introduced new legislation to allow expanded use of the state's prescription database to better target doctors who overprescribe. Prevention here is the key, but we also need an all-hands-on-deck approach to save the lives of those battling opioid and heroin addiction. And I will continue to work to increase the availability of residential treatment, recovery homes, and expanded services for outpatient treatment slots. Delaware's Prescription Drug Action Committee has developed a set of recommendations from stakeholders across the spectrum. I will make this body permanent and give it the real authority to implement a strategic approach to battling addiction in Delaware. And I've asked Lieutenant Governor Hall Long to take the lead on coordinating state efforts in this area.
Carney did take time to recognize the February hostage standoff at Vaughn Correctional Facility that left one correctional officer dead and led to calls for prison reform.
No matter how well you plan for the transition as a new governor, no one ever prepared for the tragedy that occurred on February 1st, 15 days after I took office. We lost a correctional officer, Lieutenant Stephen Floyd, and three other correctional employees were taken hostage at James T. Vaughn Correctional Center. One of those hostages is Officer Joshua Wilkinson, who's here in the chamber with us today. Officer Wilkinson, I hope you feel the love. 12 days after this horrible incident, we launched an independent review led by former Justice Henry DuPont Ridgely and former Judge Bill Chapman. I will receive their recommendations by June 1 and work quickly with the leaders of the correction committees in the House and Senate to develop a plan of action. It will not be a report that collects dust on a shelf. Officer Wilkinson, I pledge to you that we will make real improvements, and we will make them as quickly as possible.
Carney then returned to the state budget, and specifically one of the main drivers of the state's deficit.
You can't fix a structural budget problem like we have without addressing the overwhelming cost of health care. Health care costs represent $1.6 billion in our $4-plus billion budget, $800 million for Medicaid, and $800 million in employee and retiree health care costs. We have got to do something about the escalation of these costs. And I've directed Secretary Walker to design a comprehensive strategy for reducing the growth of these costs.
To conclude, Carney reached out to lawmakers, challenging them to join him in making the tough choices to set the state on solid financial ground.
We have a lot of elected officials in the room today. And I think I can speak for all of us when I say that none of us ran for office so we can cut our constituents' favorite programs or ask them to pay more in taxes. I know that all of you in the General Assembly are tired of sitting here year after year talking about how we can climb out of another budget hole. Some things are beyond our control, but this one is not. It's within our power this June to put ourselves on a more sustainable financial footing. My budget does that, and I look forward to working with each of you on your ideas to do the same. What I will not do is use budget gimmicks or one-time fixes to bail us out on June 30th, only to be right back here next year giving the same speech.
Those were some of the key parts of Governor Carney's first address to a joint session of the General Assembly. You can see the entire speech at our website, DelawarePublic.org. How did lawmakers receive the speech? We talked to a few of them moments after the governor finished to get their initial thoughts, starting on the Republican side with House Minority Leader Danny Short.
The governor's consistent. I mean, we had talked some time ago about what his objectives would be and his desires and his administration. He echoed those here today. I think I was one of the first that had a town hall meeting in my district very early on. He listened intently, which I think is a great thing, and he's right. We have a problem that's immensely big, $400 million, and we reoccurringly come here and we have the same financial issues. So we got to work together. The issue is going to be what the real details of that budget are. We've asked for that. I think we're going to get it sometime next week so we can actually scrutinize it to the nth degree and see what it is we all can agree on and see if there's some differences that what we can come together on to maybe modify them for the liking of all. So we're here to support him. Can't say we're going to support everything, but we're going to take that scrutiny and that hard look that our constituents want us to do and see where it ends up in June.
One of the first things he talked about today and one of the first things he did when he took office was talk about kind of reimagining DDO as a public-private partnership. How do you feel about that, and what would you like to see out of DDO going forward?
Well, I think he's right. We need a redevelopment of the DDO situation. Anything innovatively that gets us employment up and down the state is going to be good. I think my hometown, Seaford, is a good example, and he mentioned Seaford. We've got a huge facility down there that has about 100, 150 people working there. It had over 4,000 at one time. So as we move forward in that private and public partnership, I think you see a lot of folks that will agree that that's something we need to do. However, on the private side, the money's going to have to show up and to make it work. So that's going to be where probably the struggle is, but we need to work to help them get that way.
You also talked about looking at the Coastal Zone Act and how hard that would be. How difficult do you see looking at the Coastal Zone Act and finding that balance between protecting the natural resources of the state and being able to do maybe a little bit more on economic development there?
Well, it's a real tightrope. I know there's adamant opinions on both sides of that, I mean, on the far extreme sides. But for the overall benefit of the state of Delaware, it's a necessity. And I think the opportunity is there, and I think there's an opportunity to leverage money because some big players want to get involved, and I think it would be a benefit overall. And tied into that, not directly, but indirectly, is the discussion we're having on brownfields and the revisit of cleaning up some of the things that we probably neglected over the years. And that, I think, plays also into the Coastal Zone Act, as well as some areas downstate that I think we could take advantage of.
Anything else that stood out to you?
No, I've made a little target of everything. The one I think is, there's a number of what I would call high priority issues. He touched on the correction issue. We've got to deal with that. We've got to get to it quick. And I like the commitment he made to our correction officer here in the hall. I thought that was very touching, personal, and a commitment we all need to follow through on. The other one, which is equally important and plays right into the correction world, is the opiate problem. We've got this opiate issue that's huge. It needs higher level of attention. He's committed to doing that, and we're committed to helping. We actually have our own action team in our caucus working on it. Representative Steve Smick, a retired police officer from DSP, and others are pointedly wanting to help, as we're going to talk in a moment with about a bill from Matt Dent to maybe help solve those issues. I like to see the fact that they're elevated to this particular point, and there's meetings going on that even the press don't know about. People are interested in solving that issue. It's an issue that touches many, and many people don't know how many people it's touched because it's not something people publicly admit to because it's a little embarrassing, but at the same time, it's a family destroyer, and we've got to be able to fix it and work hard on it.
That is House Minority Leader Danny Short and his reaction to Governor Carney's address. For the Democratic reaction, we turn to House Speaker Pete Schwarzkopf.
I liked it. I thought it was well delivered and touched on a lot of different areas, but I think the message is clear. We have a shared responsibility to make this thing work and make it work for years in the future instead of having to go through this every year. And we're all kind of tired of trying to find the last penny to put to a certain budget issue. So we also made it very clear that we have a responsibility and we owe it to the Department of Corrections to fix their problems. So we have a lot of hard work ahead of us, a lot of big decisions.
And beyond that, he talked about two things. Reimagining DDO as a public-private partnership. How difficult is that to do? What are your expectations for that?
It makes sense. I mean, DDO is about businesses, so why not have businesses as part of it and helping us to do it? It makes total sense to me. I'm fully in agreement with him on that one. The best thing to do if you're trying to bring businesses here is have businesses working on behalf of you in a public-private partnership. So I'm very much on board on that one.
And then tied into that a little bit is looking at the Coastal Zone Act and seeing where maybe some more economic development can be done along the coast while still protecting natural resources. That's a tough tightrope to walk.
Yeah, this is something we've been kicking around here. We had a bill that we were a couple of my people, Representative Wozinski and Representative Longhurst, were looking at this last year, and they have legislation that they were going to bring forward last year, but then they wanted to bring in a couple more parts of the people that are affected, and there's several different groups that are working on this. I know the governor's people are working on it. We're working on it. And we're putting kind of meeting in the middle and seeing what we all agree on. This won't touch areas that have never been touched before. This will touch only, the way I understand it, I don't know where the final version will be, but the version that I know of, the one that the House is working on, is going to be only brownfields that were in use once before. Any prospective employer would have to clean up those brown fields and then put their businesses there. It would not touch any new area that hasn't been touched before.
That was House Speaker Pete Schwarzkopf. So now the question becomes, how much of what Carney proposed will he be able to deliver on? Can he rally legislators to his plans and his budget? We'll take up those questions and the rest of this week's news at Legislative Hall with political reporter James Dawson next. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In the first half of the show, we heard excerpts from Governor John Carney's address Thursday to a joint session of the General Assembly and legislative reaction to it. The speech covered a fair amount of familiar ground, laying out some of Carney's priorities in a year when new initiatives will be limited by the state's projected $386 million budget hole. Political reporter James Dawson covered the speech and this week's other action at Legislative Hall. He returns to the Green this week to help us put it all in perspective. James, thanks for being here again.
Hey, good to be here, Tom.
Well, before we dig into the details of Governor Carney's speech, let's start with, well, the start of yesterday's event.
David McBride, it is my honor and privilege on behalf of the Escort Committee to present to you our honorable governor, John C. Markell, for his special address. Oh, my goodness.
Well, you don't see that every day, do you?
No, you definitely don't. Governor John Carney was a good sport about it, though. He laughed it off and quickly recovered by calling Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long Lieutenant Governor Den, who was the one who served with Markell. Lake Hall was buzzing, though. You can see a picture that I took online that shows the exact moment when Senator Hansen realized what she had said.
It's a classic. Should go to DelawarePublic.org and check that out. But let's get to the speech. Now, that's the most important part. And as I mentioned, a lot of this was familiar terrain. Was there anything new here that we hadn't heard before from Governor Carney?
I don't think too much of it was really new. It just solidified what Carney had been suggesting for a while, and that includes saying that the Delaware Economic Development Office will be a public-private partnership in some form. He also committed to trying to retool the Coastal Zone Act, which sets a high bar for any heavy industry that wants to locate next to the Delaware River or Delaware Bay. And then he doubled down on his calls to revamp the Department of Education. He says the work is mostly happening internally, but the biggest clue that we've got is that Carney is trying to move away from dedicated funding sources that could cripple future budgets, and instead he wants to use grants that schools and districts can compete for and use however they want. It's a big step away from what Wilmington and rural lawmakers have been wanting, which is a predictable flow of cash to schools serving low-income students or those English language learners.
Though those things are likely a fight for another day. You mentioned DDO and Carney teeing up his plans to reshape that entity. The task force looking at that is expected to offer its recommendations next week. Do we have any sense of what this is going to look like?
Not specifically. The task force has had three meetings with another one set for Tuesday. And all that we know is it's going to be some sort of public-private partnership. In the past, Carney has told me that he envisions private businesses kicking in money to lure businesses here, but that's all up in the air. All I can say is that he wanted something different from the current model. The past few years, the state has kicked in between $10-20-ish million a year to either give out grants, tax breaks, or other sort of incentives to these companies. And Carney says it hasn't gotten us as much as it maybe could have.
And I thought it was interesting, Danny Short, we heard in the previous segment in his reaction, mentioned the fact that maybe the big struggle here will be getting that private money. That's where is it going to come from? Are they all going to buy in? And then that may be the bigger hurdle to get over than, in fact, just putting this thing together as a public-private partnership.
Well, they're going to have to make it worth it for those private businesses, right? You know, they're not going to just invest a few million dollars here and there if they're not seeing much in return. And that's why this is such a, interesting thing to follow. Like I said, this meeting to finalize the recommendations is happening Tuesday with the final report due to Carney on Friday.
So something we'll be keeping an eye on in the next couple of weeks. We also talked about the Coastal Zone Act and Carney trying to reexamine it to allow for more economic development opportunities along the coast of Delaware. He admitted in the speech it's going to be a lift. How heavy a lift will it be? We heard from House Minority Leader Danny Short earlier. This is kind of a tightrope for Carney to walk.
Yeah, this is probably going to be the biggest lift of his tenure so far. And the reason why is because this is where he's going to get a lot of pushback from his own party. Democrats have long been proud of the Coastal Zone Act, environmentalists too, even though it was signed into law by a Republican governor, Russ Peterson, in the 1970s. So we're talking about extremely strict regulations that outright ban new heavy industry anywhere along the Delaware Bay or Delaware River. And any other industry has to go through a permitting process with the state to get approved, and they have to show that they won't negatively affect the environment. But part of the problem it's created is that these sites were already polluted and the companies didn't clean it up before they left town or went bankrupt. And sea level rise could leach those toxic piles into the water source. And Carney really wants to incentivize other businesses to go in, take care of the pollution, and set up shop, create new jobs.
But there does seem to be some, perhaps, support on the Democratic side. Talking to Pete Schwarzkopf, we heard him earlier say the House has been working, at least House Democrats have been working, on some kind of version of this type of action that would limit it to brownfields that were already previously industrial ones, but not touch any new land. That may be perhaps the path, the narrow path that Carney has.
Well, and that's what I've been hearing too, especially from new Senator Stephanie Hansen. She's an environmental real estate lawyer by trade, and, and brownfields is really her bread and butter.
Right.
And that's exactly what she wants to target too, is cleaning up these polluted sites and, you know, just really negating the potential impact that they might have in the future.
They sell it as a win-win, which is like these places are already polluted. The businesses are going to come in and clean them up for us. That's a win. And then the businesses will put something there that will create jobs. Another win. Question is, yeah, will the environmental groups and others see it the same way? We'll keep an eye on that one as well. One area that everyone seems to be on board with following this speech was Carney's call to address the opiate crisis here in the first state. But how much, again, there can get done considering the budget limitations this year?
Well, lawmakers are really trying to take a more regulatory approach, so there is some wiggle room. One bill would bar insurance companies from requiring that addicts have a prior referral or be in a crisis to get checked into these live-in treatment centers. And I've heard from several people who said that they were denied when they tried to get help because they weren't, quote, sick enough to get a bed there. Companies could also require checkups in the early stages of treatment. And we're talking a couple days in here. And if they thought you were doing well enough, they'd kick you out. And an addiction treatment can take a long time to break those habits or even get someone completely through withdrawal. So that, you know, advocates are saying that would be a big help there. Another bill would give addicts and their families access to state lawyers who can help them if an insurance company denies their claim. And that money would come from the Consumer Protection Fund within the Department of Justice. And that's paid for when states win lawsuits, usually from companies that commit fraud. And Attorney General Matt Dehn, who's backing these bills, says the fund typically has a big surplus year after year, and it should be more than enough to pay for itself. And then the last piece are these new opioid prescription regulations that were finalized a while ago. They're kicking in April, and they basically limit how many pills doctors can prescribe for short-term patients and then really crack down on long-term treatment if the patient no longer needs these drugs.
Anything else stand out in the speech or the reaction to it?
Not so much. I thought the speech was, well, I mean, it was much shorter than we're used to, about 25 minutes in length. I think Carney's just reinforcing his priorities. Some lawmakers I've spoken to have been disappointed that there haven't been many grand ideas that he's thrown out so far, but he might be handcuffed due to the budget.
The other big news in Dover this week, and you broke this story, a bill legalizing recreational marijuana is here. Tell us the key features of this bill.
That's right. So it would be legal for anyone 21 years or older to buy marijuana. And in all, 40 retail stores would be allowed to open, with current medical marijuana dispensaries getting a head start. If it does pass, smoking in public would still be banned. You wouldn't be able to grow any of your own plants at home. Other than that, it's really regulated mostly like alcohol. These stores would have the same hours, things like that. The money, though, would get split between the Department of Education and the Health Department, with the rest going to the general fund. And when it's fully implemented, the Marijuana Policy Project projects $22 million coming in for the first year. But past estimations for states that have legalized pot have been vastly underestimated in the past.
So it'll be very interesting to watch. The obvious question, of course, is how much of a shot does this bill have, especially since Governor Carney has signaled he's more or less against it, at least at this particular juncture?
Right. The odds at face value aren't great. So you're going to need a two-thirds majority to pass this bill because it creates new criminal penalties for stores that sell pot to underage people. And that's going to be pretty hard right now. Even though 61% of Delawareans support full legalization, you have a lot of former cops as state legislators and others who are close to law enforcement that aren't necessarily friendly to these types of laws. So right now, the bill has 14 co-sponsors, one Republican. You're going to need plenty more to pass this, but Democrats might be able to get the GOP on board with some creative horse trading. There's still 50% of that cash flow that's not earmarked that could fund programs like farmland preservation, open space, that have been continually been stripped by the Markell administration and the Carney administration, too, at least in his proposal. Medical marijuana passed in 2011 with only two Republican sponsors, so maybe it can get done again.
Be interesting to watch. James Dawson, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
And remember, you can keep up with all of James Dawson's coverage of politics here in the First State online anytime at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues in a moment with a look at the future of a pair of Delaware shopping malls, Concord Mall and Dover Mall. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Malls were once a staple of shopping, especially for those living in the suburbs. But many of them these days are struggling. One retail analyst predicts 400 of the country's 1,100 enclosed malls will fold in the coming years, a forecast that seems even more likely with longtime anchor stores like Macy's and Sears announcing they're closing a number of locations nationwide. And some trying to avoid that fate are reimagining themselves, bringing in unconventional anchor tenants. In Delaware, Christiana Mall's numbers and prime location at the intersection of I-95 and Route 1 would appear to make it safe. But what about the others, such as the Concord Mall in North Wilmington and Dover Mall? Contributor Eileen Dalabrida took a look at where those malls fit into the landscape in her new piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And she joins us here on The Green to talk about what she found. Eileen, thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Tom.
So, are malls essentially becoming retail dinosaurs?
Well, traditional malls are indeed retail dinosaurs. There hasn't been a traditional enclosed shopping mall built in America in more than 10 years. So it would appear that ship has sailed.
And locally, as we mentioned, Christiana Mall seems okay. Did it wind up kind of getting ahead of the curve in the reinventing process?
Well, Christiana Mall had to change. Two of its anchors were gone because of consolidation in department stores when Strawbridges went away. They had a seriously underperforming Lord & Taylor's that went away. So what they did was what several other successful malls did in transforming themselves, and that is to kind of make themselves into a lifestyle center, to bring in more restaurants, to make it more of a bright and inviting place. They added entertainment. They managed to get Nordstrom to locate there, and it's a tremendous success story.
And they also, I guess, you know, got lucky as well in the fact that they wound up having an Apple store that draws a lot of people because of tax-free shopping. And what was built kind of around the Christiana Mall helped kind of make the whole area a little bit more attractive for shopping.
Yes, that Apple store is a gold mine. It's a wonderful tenant. They sell more iPhones there than any other place in America. Plus, there's retail development all around, and because of its location and that critical mass, it's become a true regional hub.
So let's talk about the other malls here in the first state, starting with Concord Mall. Two of its main anchors, Macy's and Sears, are closing stores around the country. And inside the Concord Mall, it also seems to have many defectors as well there in terms of stores leaving. Is the Concord Mall in trouble?
Well, the Concord Mall is privately held and it doesn't release figures, but I can tell you that there have been a number of smaller retailers that have left the mall. PacSun, which was very popular with shoppers, and that there are just a lot of recent exits. But the mall is clean. It's well kept. It doesn't look like it's, you know, going to fall down or anything. But it really is impacted by what is going on in retail land, and that is Macy's and Sears, its two anchors, being in serious trouble.
On the plus side, I guess, though, that the Concord Mall still has a solid location. Is that a factor in how well it may be able to kind of keep on going and have time to change course a little bit if necessary?
Well, it certainly strikes me as a property worth investing in. It is the first major retail hub that you come to when you get over that Pennsylvania line, and it has it doesn't have a lot of room to grow, but I think that if one of those anchors did go away, that might indeed give that Concord Mall an opportunity to reinvent itself.
Let's talk about the Dover Mall. Its owners seem to be banking on a plan to make it more accessible to Route 1 traffic that flows by it. What's the story there with Dover Mall? What are they trying to do?
Well, they are trying to fast-track a $31 million road improvement that would essentially funnel shoppers directly from Route 1. It would give Dover Mall a presence on Route 1. But this is a difficult task to accomplish, because it's Macy's is officially in trouble. It has been listed on Morningstar's list of Macy's that are expected to close because its sales are very poor. And I don't know if time is on their side. It takes a long, even if they did prevail in building this access, that takes a long time. And I believe what the people in Kent County are telling me is that if the mall had better access, that would be an incentive for the owners to put some money into it and transform it from a traditional shopping mall to something more exciting, as Christiana has done. But I don't know if the time frame would work for them.
Yeah, and we just learned this week that the legislation to kind of enable the public-private partnership that would allow this work to be done on the access roads and a toll booth that would help pay for it is being introduced this week in the state legislature. So they are trying to move that ball quickly, but as you said, how quickly it gets through the legislature and then how quickly they could actually pull the project together, as you said, time just isn't on their side. But moving on to the idea that both Concord and Dover Mall seem to need the change in some way, perhaps dramatically. Are there other properties regionally that might give a clue as to what direction Concord and or Dover Mall could go? And do any of these ideas seem more successful than others at this juncture?
Well, Plymouth Meeting has done really well. They were in serious trouble, and they have embraced Legoland. They have Whole Foods. Both big draws that aren't stores that you would traditionally find in a shopping mall. Cherry Hill Mall in South Jersey, the oldest mall east of the Mississippi, really is a dazzling example of a successful redevelopment. And in fact, Christiana's model, they borrowed their playbook from Cherry Hill. And Echelon Mall in Voorhees in South Jersey was pretty much on its last legs, and it has been completely revamped. Condos, shops, restaurants, and the municipal building for the township has been relocated there.
Very interesting possibilities, all of them, and perhaps ones that could be duplicated at a Dover Mall or a Concord Mall. But all this discussion we're having, Eileen, is kind of in front of the backdrop of online shopping and the fact that has become so much more part of retail's landscape. And in the end, is there only so much malls can do in the face of online shopping at this juncture, no matter what they do in terms of reimagining themselves?
Well, I think that brick-and-mortar centers have become much more savvy in the symbiosis that they can create with online retail, that there are now apps at various Simon properties, and Simon is the owner of Dover Mall, where as you stroll through a shopping center, a lifestyle center, or a shopping mall, you can pick up on promotions from various retailers. Many brick-and-mortar stores now invite people to order online and pick up at the store, and you can also return things to the store. And surveys are showing that those kinds of transactions have become very good for brick-and-mortar stores, that the 23% of customers who pick up an online order at a store buy something else while they're at it. And even when shoppers are returning something, 1 in 5 of those buy something when they're in the store.
So there is some hope for the mighty mall.
There is some hope for the mighty mall.
Eileen Dalabria, thanks so much for your time this week here on The Green.
Thanks, Tom.
And a reminder, Eileen's story on the future of malls is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next up, we finish out The Green this week with our latest edition of History Matters. Stay with us. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. This month's History Matters, produced in collaboration with the Delaware Historical Society, was inspired by University of Delaware Black Studies professor Tiffany Gill's book, Beauty Shop Politics, African American Women's Activism in the Beauty Industry. Dr. Gill explores how self-employed African-American beauticians often played an underground role in the civil rights movement. For example, having NAACP pamphlets and other similar mail sent secretly to their under-the-radar storefronts. Gill's primary focus is on beauty shops in the South, but we wondered if shops locally played a similar role. To find out, Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauley spoke with Wilmington residents and local historians about their recollections of and research into Delaware's beauty shop industry.
Hair is the thing. You sit down even in the darkest and the poorest parts of Africa or other countries. Somebody or a child or a young adult or a teenager is sitting down getting their hair done.
That's Florence Collins Hardy, who grew up on Wilmington's east side. She says the frequent routine of having her hair straightened by Mrs. Burton, whose hair salon was above Mr. Burton's pool hall, was quite special and was a big part of the city's African-American culture.
It gives you that place of belonging, that place of security, that place where you can talk about anything and somebody is standing there doing your hair and listening to what you have to say. Whether they agree, whether they disagree, whether they will advise you or not advise you, doesn't matter. The fact is, while you're in that chair or you're in that bogey, you are the center of attention.
Wilmington Bishop Aretha Morton also grew up on the east side, where her mother, Lorraine, worked as a hairdresser. But before that, she did domestic work for white families.
Some of the folk that she worked for, back in the day, they weren't too kind, you know. So I think that was really what pushed her to want to be her own boss.
Morton remembers one incident at a home where her mother, Lorraine, was working that really pushed her to pursue a more independent career as a beautician.
It had the big plantation post, more or less. And whoever it was, the woman wanted her to get on a ladder and scrub the post down, you know? And, of course, she said as soon as the woman told her that's what she wanted her to do, she got the bucket and the rag or whatever, and she sat it off to the side. She went in the house and got her coat, put it on, and came out and caught the bus. She just flatly refused to do it.
Lorraine went on to attend Mrs. Dora S. Lee's beauty school on East 10th Street, eventually joining other beauty school graduates all dressed in white during graduation at the Walnut Street YMCA, before going on to open her own shop. Lorraine was one of many African-American small business owners in Wilmington at that time, making her own schedule and only serving other African-Americans.
She would put a curl in, and the curl would be tight, you know, which meant if she did that like that, the person would supposedly come back in 2 weeks. But because the hair was done so tight and perfect, they would come by and they'd say, Lorraine, I'm not coming this week. I'll be here next week because, see, my hair's lasted. And then she would laugh and say, well, next time I'm not going to put that curl in as tight as I did before.
Retired University of Delaware Black Studies professor Jim Newton says there was an emergence of an elite African-American middle class in Delaware after what's known as the Great Migration. Millions of African-Americans fled the South in the late 1800s after widespread lynchings.
And so Black decided that enough was enough, packed their bags, and came north.
That included physician Samuel G. Elbert, who helped found the National Negro Business League with Booker T. Washington. He was among the many progressive Blacks to settle in Wilmington.
The upward emergent Black middle class took on a life of its own. Clubs and sororities and social orders, all that began to take place.
Elbert and others like him set up shop and worked hard to develop the area for Blacks.
Doctors owned the drugstore. They owned the only black theater. They owned. Okay? And they owned most of the stuff. The result was they became the elite.
It was also the era of the Walker system, a beauty system similar to Avon, created by Madam C.J. Walker, an African-American entrepreneur, philanthropist, and political activist.
And the Walker system had to have pomades and gels, and she created all that. In jars, you got to comb it and part it and do all that, and that straight look.
Walker enlisted agents to help sell the hair products going door-to-door, and in 1917 hosted the first national convention for her Walker beauty culturists in Philadelphia. Though local businesses were very much segregated across the country, there was a very different attitude between whites and blacks in the South and the North.
So the racism up here and the racism down South, different. Racism down South, it's more blatant.
That's Collins Hardy again.
We didn't have as much of the fear of being bugged or looked at because the NAACP and other groups were out there. And it was okay.
And that applied to the beauty shops too.
So we had more people and more things. We had a different population. So the beauty shop industry and the politics wasn't necessarily, it didn't have to be as underground because we had more people of status.
But that doesn't mean beauty shops in Wilmington weren't used for political organizing like they were in the South.
There was a lot of, for lack of a better word, there was a lot of political stuff going on. It really was, but
that's Bishop Aretha Morton again.
Because my mom used the shop and the house from time to time for the polls. They even, this is a funny, but when they wanted people to vote a certain way, they get half pints of alcohol.
She said those pints of alcohol would be served at the door of her mom's beauty shop, Lorraine's Beauty Shop. Morton said she never thought of her mother as being a part of history until hearing Dr. Gill's talk about beauty shop politics, but says there's a little of that still happening today.
And it's almost like it is now. You know, we sit around and we talk about who we're going to vote for, whether they're going to be right or wrong for the community and what have you. And the community back in the day, there's so many desires that we had, and our African American population, naturally, they say they were going to do as best they can to serve the community in the best way that they could, and they did.
But she says some things have changed. For example, the flexibility to change careers on a whim, which wouldn't have been so easy in the early 1900s. Morton says her granddaughter went to beauty school and then changed her mind.
She said, "Grandma, I don't want to do no hair." I said, "Girl, you have got to be kidding." She said, "No." And she doesn't. She doesn't.
Although Morton says most of what she calls the old school beauty shops like her mom's are no longer in existence, she says there are a few old timers still around and still doing hair. And even though Morton says her mom, Lorraine, was often too busy with clients to do her hair, she still has her mother's curling iron. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Megan Pauley.
Thanks, Megan. And a reminder that History Matters is produced in collaboration with the Delaware Historical Society. And that's it for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We'd also like to hear from you. Send us your feedback and story ideas at our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's James Dawson and Megan Pauley, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.